So we left off last time. We were on the top of Daf Lamed Daled Amud Beis, and we had finished the discussion about the treatise, the leftover stuffs of the after they press the wine, and now we're on to fish oil. Okay, apparently they valued omega-3 back then as well. And the term for fish oil, I assume that's what shuman dagim is. It could be fish fat, but I assume it's fish oil. Shuman dagim is called murias. So the Gemara, which is five lines down, the Mishnah had said, just to review a second, because the Mishnah had said that with respect to murias and gvinas beis unyaki, the gvina, the cheese made in a certain place of non-Jews, so Rabbi Meir said they were aser. One could not eat them, and they were asur b'hana. And the Chachamim said, no, the ein isur and isur hana, which implies that there is an isur achila, but there's no isur hana. So now the Gemara says, Tan Rabbanan, murias uman mutar. If you have professionally produced fish oil, so it's permissible to consume it. So the assumption is that this is being said with respect to the Mishnah, that the Mishnah, Tosus points out, that the Chachamim, when they prohibit Murias in the Mishnah, they're prohibiting Balabatish Murias, right? Now, does the Balabata make it? So then you have to be concerned that they mix some wine in. But Umanim don't want to mix wine in, apparently. It's not good for the fish oil. It kind of ruins it. Okay, by the time you get to the third, what we'll see, sometimes they mix it in because the fish oil isn't so good to start with, so it's to their benefit to do so. So Tana Rabbana, Murias Uman Mutta, Rabbi Yehuda ben Gamliel Omer, Mishum Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel, Af Chilak Uman Mutter. So what is Chilak? So Rashi explains, Chilak was a certain kind of fish that I think they used to, chop it up, but apparently it's a fish that when it's very small it doesn't have fins and scales, and only when it gets older does it grow them. So such a fish, in fact, is considered kosher. But you can't look at the little fish and you can't actually see them, so you have to be a little bit of an expert in it. So apparently Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel felt that when Balabatim produce it, so they may get other small fish with it as well, and they're not so expert to distinguish between the two, and they package it all together. But apparently the other fish aren't so good for the flavor, so Umanim, who are experts, so they don't want the adulterating effects of the other fish, and therefore there's no concern that when you go into the store, you buy a chilak from an Uman, there's no concern about the non-kosher fish being mixed in. Tani Avimi Bereid Rabbi Abahu Murias Uman Mutar. So Rabbi Abimi taught in the name of Rabbi Abahu. In fact, any of you, if anybody's doing Daf Yomi, I don't remember if it's tomorrow's Daf or Tuesday's Daf or today's Daf. So Avimi was one of the exemplars that the Gemara cites, Rabbi Abahu cites, of being the epitome of being Mekayim Kibud Av V'Em. Apparently, he had five young strapping sons, sounds like they were musmachim, I'm not sure what that means, they were smichei, and yet when his father would come to the door, he wouldn't let any of them go assist, he'd be screaming, I'm coming. So apparently he was tremendously mechabed his father, he didn't let his children do it because it was his mitzvah. So this is Avimi. So Avimi Braid the Rabbi Abahu cites his father saying as follows, Murias Uman is mutter. We saw that already. But who tanila v'hu amarle? He quoted the braisa, but then he quotes the explanation, which is, Pam Rishon, Visheni mutter, shlishi aser. So apparently what the Uman would, when you make the fish fat, what you would do is you would kind of soak the fish and try to extract the fat. I guess you could use water because even so the oil will separate from the water. So the first two times it's mutter to consume that. In other words, I guess, I don't know if these were olive oils, extra virgin olive oil, virgin olive oil, and then regular olive oil. So the first two rounds you're allowed to consume. The third one you're not allowed to consume. My time, so the Gemara says, Pam Rishon Visheni, Dinafish Shum Nahu Lo Tzarech Lemir Me Behu Chamer. The first two times there's so much fish oil coming out that you don't need to adulterate it at all. However, the next time around, shlishi mikan ve'elach rama b'huchamra, they would put in wine. I don't know if the wine was to supplement, if the wine was to help extract the fish oil, but whatever it was, you now had stam yenam, you had wine, non-kosher wine mixed in the third batch of fish oil. Okay. The Gemara tells a story. Hahu arba de moryasa de asti linamela de ako. So apparently there was a boat in Arva, and it was a boat carrying moryas. It was the fish oil boat. And it docked in the Namel, which is the harbor of Akko. So, Osiv Rabbi Abba de min Akko notore bahada. Rabbi Abba, who was from Akko, literally seated, but it means he established, or he set up, notore, which are watchmen, like the notore karta, the watchmen of the city. So he set up the watchers to check, keep an eye on the boat, that nobody put stuff on the boat, nobody tried to swap the merchandise. Now his assumption was that the moryas coming on the boat was kosher. And therefore he wanted to make sure that nobody got their hands on it and swapped cargo and so on, that maybe could introduce treif moryas. So Amar Le, they said to him, Ad haidana amanatra. He said to him, one second, that's nice. It's like when the truck rolls up, you know, from the factory, you keep people watching, so nobody switched up. But how do you know it was kosher? How do you know somewhere in between? The truck drivers in the interim did go and mix stuff in. So he says to him, what do you mean? What are you concerned about? If you're concerned that they're going to mix wine into it. So he says, no. Kista de moryas beluma, kista de chamra bedal lume. In the place that this fish oil came from, the cost a kista is a measurement. So the measurement of a certain amount of moryas costs one luma. It's a coin, a certain value. However, the same amount of wine is four times the price. So this goes back to a point I mentioned many times. We do not assume that non-Jews are out to get us in terms, even if they are, we don't assume they're out to get us by trafing up our food. Right? So they're not looking for opportunities to mix trade food in. So if there's a financial disincentive to do so, we assume they're not going to do it. If there's a financial incentive, then we might be concerned. So Amar Le, Rav Yirmiya le Rabbi Zeira, Dilma Aidi Ditzor Asu, Dishvi Chabra. So Rav Yirmiya says to Zeira, maybe, you know, it passed, it came down the coast. Before it got to Akko, it passed Tyre, it passed Tzor, and maybe it stopped there. And there, apparently, wine is very cheap. Shvi Chabra. Rashi says the word Shvi means it's Bizol. So maybe they stopped there and somebody mixed in wine there. So Amar Le, Hasam Ikule Upashure Ika. He said, apparently, this time of year, it wasn't high tide, but it was the sea was more swollen, and it was very, very hard to dock boats in Tzor at that time, and therefore it's unlikely that they would have tried, and therefore you don't have to be concerned. Fine, so that's the end of this. So the Gemara assumes that moryas, first couple of batches of moryas are mutar, after that it's a prop. Okay. Bizman Hazeh, I don't know, I know they sometimes sell the fish oil caplets, but I don't think those are considered roi lachila. In fact, I think they're enclosed in a sleeve. So it doesn't even, I'm sure they're not mixing in wine, but it probably would not be an issue. And as a general rule in terms of medicines, if a medicine is not chewable, if it's only swallowable, so with the exception possibility of maybe something like chametz on Pesach or Yayin Nesach, outside of that consideration, there's no concern of something being not kosher. It has to be something that can be chewed and has some type of a flavor. Then you can talk about, you know, what the ingredients are. But if it's simply swallowed, so it wouldn't be an issue. So
what happens if it's in liquid form, like you put some fish oil as a spoon?
So that already could be, that's theoretically roi lachila. But when it comes in a caplet, so then it shouldn't be an issue. Again, I imagine today they're not mixing wine in it. They maybe could have all sorts of other treif ingredients, but they're probably not going to be our problem. And even if the oil were from a treif fish, it still wouldn't matter. It's still not derech achila. It's derech refuah. Okay. Fine. Now the Gemara, we get to finally cheese. Gvinas beis unyake. So, apparently, it was the cheese only from a certain place. Now, one of the interesting things about the Mishnah is the Mishnah never says, doesn't talk about, what about cheese from every place other than beis unyake? The assumption that everybody makes is that Gvina, in this case, is that Gvina generally is Asura. Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim were arguing about one particular location where there might have been a problem that would make the cheese not only prohibited to consume, but also to get any benefit from. So Rabbi Meir said that the cheese that comes from this place, not only can't you eat it, you can't get Hana, which obviously tells you it has something to do with Avodah Zarah. The Chachamim say, no, It's Eini Surin Isser Hana. So you're allowed to get benefit from the cheese, but you're not allowed to eat the cheese. The assumption is, and the Gemara will get to that in the next sugya on Daf Lamed Hey, is that the all cheese of a non-Jew is Aser Bachila. The question is why. But for the moment, the Gemara is interested here only in why does Rabbi Meir concern and say that Gvinas Beis Unyaki is Aser Bahana. So the Gemara will get to this in a moment, but I want to sort of fill in, before we read the text itself, a basic debate that exists in many places in Shas, and that is the question of what's known as Chayshinan Limi'uta. As a general rule, min haTorah, when we have a situation of doubt, so you follow the majority, you follow a rov, you follow a probability. And in some cases, we even say that that's actually, practically speaking, halacha. So I've given my example numerous times already, and of, if you have two pieces of kosher meat and one piece of treif meat sitting in front of you, all three look identical, you know two are kosher. So according to the Rush, one person can take all three, stick it on a club sandwich, and eat it together. And according to the Rush Bar, you can't eat it at the same time, but you can eat one, and then you can eat the second, and you can eat the third. And some require you to only eat all but one piece. But the bottom line is, in principle, we say, Azlin on Basaruba, you follow a rove. Rabbi Meir apparently has something of a different opinion in some cases. Now, first, sort of what I'll call the or case, what Rabbi Meir actually says. And then we'll talk about what the Bavli sort of extrapolates and then establishes as this very broad principle, but sometimes one wonders whether or not it's a good extrapolation. Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim have a debate whether or not a katan or a katana, a minor, are allowed to participate in the ritual of Yibam. A katan, if a man dies without children, and he has a brother, and the brother is a minor, he's a katan. So a katan cannot do chalitza. That's exeris akashuv. Kakasuv, im lo yachpos ha'ish, ish prat lekatan. So a minor is not eligible to do the ceremony of chalitza. On some level, the reason for that is because the ceremony itself is symbolic, and to do a symbolic ceremony, you need to have sort of a higher level of intent, and a minor is not capable of having that level of intent.
Bar mitzvah, we're talking about bar mitzvah.
Bar mitzvah, yes, that's from my minor. The same thing holds true if the man, let's say, man died, his brother is a gadol, but his brother's wife is a katana. She's a minor. Let's say her father married her off, so you could even have what's called kiddushei Torah. She was really married on a Torah level because her father provided the intent or the das there. But now she wants that, you know, she wants to be free, so, or she doesn't want to be stuck where she is. A katana cannot do chalitza. Okay, katana can't do chalitza. However, the question arises, can a katan or a katana do yibum? Are they allowed to perform the levirate marriage? Why would that work? It would work because the act of consummating that marriage requires, as a fundamental act, it requires less intent, less das. So the assumption of the Gemara is that a katan and a katana are actually capable of doing, are able to do yibum. Katan Aktana Kedivim. The situation of a katan is a very interesting situation because it might be a situation, the only situation where a minor male is able to marry, but it's only a minatorah, it's recognized by the Torah, but it's only a quasi-marriage. But a katana who would undergo the Yibam ceremony, she's fully married. She's married to the brother, the living brother, the same way she was married to the dead brother. So the Chachamim say that a katan or a katana are not chotzin, but they can do they can be miyabin, they can do yibam. Question is, but Rabbi Meir says no. Why does Rabbi Meir say no? So Rabbi Meir was concerned about the following. Generally speaking, any of the living brothers may do yibam to any one wife of the deceased. Assuming the deceased had more than one wife, you need one brother and one wife, and everybody else is off the hook. Once that one brother and one wife do yibam or chalitza. Okay. However, should a brother turn out to be a saris, if he turns out to be a eunuch, in this case a srischama, someone from birth who is simply not just infertile, but there's something not properly formed about his reproductive organs, so a saris cannot do yibam or chalitza. It's like, for the purposes, if you're trying to envision the scenario of yibam, you imagine that there is no brother. If he was the only living brother when the man died, there's just no yibam or chalitza. If there are other brothers, his actions are meaningless. Now, but they're not totally meaningless, because a saris who were to do yibum, not only is he not fulfilling the obligation that this woman needs of yibum, but he's violating a severe Torah prohibition, because at this point, he's still a brother. A brother is not allowed, a man is not allowed to marry his brother's wife. The Torah makes an exception. It carves out an exception when you have the mitzvah of Yibum. Namely, the brother dies without children, and he has a living brother who qualifies to do Yibum. But if the living brother doesn't qualify to do Yibum, if that brother is not qualified, like a Saris, so for him, marrying, having a relationship with his brother's wife, would be like his brother had children. It's called Eishes Ach Shelo B'Makom Mitzvah. So Rabbi Meir says that a katan is not allowed to do yibum. You know why? Because we are afraid that when he does yibum and then he grows up, he reaches the age of majority, and then all of a sudden we realize something's wrong, and it turns out that he's a saris. And it turns out retroactively, or you know, certainly if the wife was a gedola, she violated an isur kares unintentionally, but nonetheless. So Rabbi Meir says saris may not do, a katan may not do yibum because we're afraid shema yimatze saris. Similarly, if a man had died and he had multiple wives and no children, and one of them was what's called an ilonis, which is the female equivalent of the saris, she never undergoes puberty under normal circumstances, or something not just infertile, but something beyond that. So an ilonis is also not included in the parasha of Yibam or Chalitza, which means that if a man dies with multiple wives, doing one of his brothers doing Yibam or Chalitza with the woman who's an Ilonis accomplishes nothing in terms of freeing the other wives. It's like you haven't done Yibam or Chalitza. Now, if you do Chalitza, big deal. Okay, so you untied somebody's shoes. It has no ramifications. But if you do Yibam, once again, it's Eishes Ach Shelo B'Makom Mitzvah, because you're having a relationship with your brother's wife who's not qualified to do the mitzvah of Yibam. And therefore, Rabbi Meir says that a ketana is not allowed to have Yibam because maybe she, when she reaches the age of majority, will turn out to be an Ilonis. Now, what...
Go free?
What's that?
Does that one wife get to go
yes.
free?
Yes. She's
out.
Correct. She is out. So Rabbi Meir pen out, what is the probability, what is the statistical probability that the katan or ketana are going to be a saris or an islandist? The answer is not very high. Nonetheless, Rabbi Meir is chayish lemi'uta. That's Rabbi Meir. That's the way the Gemara explains this machlokas. That Rabbi Meir is concerned about even the minority, even though the Chachamim say, look, you follow a rov. And rov ketanim are not going to be sarisim. Rov ketanos are not going to be ilonios. So Rabbi Meir says, no, chayshin al-mi'utha. We're concerned about this very tiny majority. Rabbi Meir's position is a little hard to understand on some level, but okay, I understand sometimes we don't want to take even small risks. The Gemara, however, sort of extrapolates this to be a larger and broader principle throughout Shas, and says that Rabbi Meir is always choshesh lemiyuta, not just in this case, and one could have argued this case is particularly severe because the ramifications are great. But apparently, the Bavli understands that Rabbi Meir's Shita, again, Rabbi Meir doesn't say a word about Miyut. Rabbi Meir just says, a katan and a katana cannot do Yibam, because katan shema yimatze saris, katana shema timatze ilonis. The Gemara extrapolates from that this broad principle of Rabbi Meir, that chayshinan lemi'uta. It's a very, very interesting issue. Yes, Marshall.
Question. Given the extreme statistical improbability of those events, it almost seems like something else is bothering Rabbi Meir, and this is a cover story. And so I guess the question is, do any achronim or afterwards sort of trace his hashkafa in other areas and say, really, he just didn't want a katan, for example, to do a yibum based on what he says in other, you know, sugyas, but he had to hang it on something else because he was trapped, so he came up with this exceedingly almost absurd justification.
So for two reasons, the answer to that question, I think, is going to be no.
It might be more than one person at stake also because the other, if they're not really free, then they go marry out.
So that's true, although the stakes are, for the way we paskin, relatively low, because there's no mamzeris involved, because the Yavam al-Ashuk is only a lav. I'm gonna agree with you that Libi Omer Li, on a pshat level, I wonder whether something else is going on. Nobody is going to say otherwise, methodologically, for two reasons. As a general rule, if the Bavli interprets a shita in this way and uses it in extensive number of applications, none of the Rishonim or Achronim are going to come along and challenge that. And number two, it yields such interesting conceptual fodder, this idea of Chayshin al-Miyuta, that who wants to throw that all away and give some pedestrian reason that it affects other people, you know? I think... My guess would very strongly be I'm in sympathy with that argument. I do wonder, it's such a strange Matthias, although we'll talk about it a little bit here, because the Gemara is going to raise its applicability or non-applicability here, and it will provide, I think, a slightly alternate way of looking at it. As I like to say, I think that the Jake has heard this from me, but I won't ask him to answer the question. What is the probability that I've never played golf, real golf, in my life? I go out tomorrow and I take my first swing. What's the probability I get a hole in one?
Will or you won't.
I will or I won't. 50%. Okay, so that's not really true, but that's discrete possibilities, right? And that may be what's going on. There are situations in halacha where we don't follow statistics, but rather we follow what I'll call discrete possibilities. The classic example of this is the principle of kol kavua kemechtza mechtza dami. If I have 10 butcher shops that are selling meat, 9 of them are selling kosher meat, and 1 of them is selling treif meat. If one piece is found, you know, a little birdie came and took a piece of meat out of the shop and stuck it in the middle, and I come and find that piece of meat, you follow a rove. Rove of the butcher shops are kosher, you can eat the meat. Okay, but if I walked into one of those stores, and each one, you know, 9 of them had a badatz certificate, and 1 of them had a certificate that said glot treif, and so I could have looked up and just seen which I was buying. It's known when the iser is kavua b'mkomo. I walk in and I buy one, and now I say, oigval, there was one store that was treif, now I'm a kosher. The halacha treats this, it seems, mid the oraisa as kol kavua kemechtza mechtza dami. It's treated as a bona fide suffix. And so the question is, that seems to be a very strange, how do you explain that concept? That's why I guess give my hole-in-one analogy, is that when the Isser, when your relationship with the Isser begins in a place where it is distinguishable, then we follow possibilities rather than probabilities. So it seems that Rabbi Meir might be working sort of in a similar vein here. You'll see why in a second. I want to suggest that that could be what's going on. But im kol zeh, I do think, I'm still suspicious that maybe there's something in the background, but we don't have any data of which to pull it out. Yeah.
At the end of the day, though, of course, the katan will be a gadol in a few years, so they will grow out of the
situation.
Correct.
This is
so. If you wait, they're not talking katan at 4 years old doing yibum, I assume. Probably talking 9 years old and up, right?
I mean, the consideration would only be yes. Only a 9 year old is only a 9 year old is physically / halachically capable of doing yibum. Agreed. The case is not. This is not a question of so much a practical issue. It's more a theoretical issue. I mean, I'm sure it did come up. There are situations where women were stuck waiting for a yavam katan or a tefkan gadol, whatever it is. But okay.
Is yes. There a circumstance where this miyuta scenario or shita actually is toface and is a viewpoint that the Gemara holds by? I mean, does it, elsewhere does Rav Meir's position have particular import?
I don't want to say no, but nothing that comes to mind. As the Gemara will usually identify it as, they'll say, Rabbi Meir hu d'chayish l'miyuta. That's a way of sort of dismissing a shita in terms of halachic import.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. I mean, I don't want to say, you know, there are always areas in halacha where we add chumrah on top of chumrah on top of chumrah. It's not framed in terms of rov and miut, because for whatever reason, but I don't know if there's any case in where it's framed as, you know, in this case we hold like Rabbi Meir. Isaac, good question.
I was going to say, the Gemara is full of examples of scenarios that almost will never happen. And I believe that maybe Rabbi Meir's Shita is based on fine-tuning, you know, really getting to the crux of the matter, really understanding what's happening here. In other words, I mean, I did an example like in early Kiddushin with Daf Yomi is, you know, they're talking about this, if a man is having sex with a woman and somebody, in the middle of sex, somebody gives her a star, and you know who she is, and it's a scenario that will never happen.
Okay.
So maybe Rav Meir wants to get to the finest point of halacha. Maybe he wants to fine-tune it. I can't even express what I'm going to say.
This is a real metzias.
Happened to him. You're a lucky guy.
It's infrequent. This is an infrequent case. It's an infrequent case. I'm glad I wasn't teaching that daf and daf. Feel me? This is an infrequent. I know. But this is not as such. This is statistically infrequent, but it's real. In other words, the phenomenon of saris or eilonis were very real. They weren't common. They were certainly a miut she'eino matsui, as we would term it, an uncommon, you know, miut.
Him turning out to be a eunuch is the statistical improbability.
Correct. Correct. In other words, but it's real. In other words, it's not a hypothetical scenario. It's a concern over an unlikely possibility. That's not an unlikely possibility. That's just a theoretical construction. This is very real. Statistically infrequent, but very real.
Does Rabbi Meir use this principle of possibility consistently or just in this case?
So the best I can tell, nowhere else, in other words, the Gemara will attribute this as the underlying basis for Rabbi Meir Shaita here, there, or another place. But Rabbi Meir himself never uttered these words in terms of I'm choshesh for mi ucheinu matzoi. It is sort of the Bavli's, and maybe I don't remember if it's Amoraic or from the anonymous layer of the Gemara, it's their interpretation of Rabbi Meir Shita, and then they will say here, when they have to explain something Rabbi Meir, they'll say, this is what's going on there. I don't know if anybody sat down. I mean, I think what will happen is if you wanted to do an intellectual biography of Rabbi Meir and line up every one of Rabbi Meir's shitas and see, is he always choshesh l'miuta? Now, in the cases when it's clear that he's not, what you can expect is the Rishonim might start asking the question, well, why isn't Rabbi Meir choshesh l'miuta there? Again, my gut tells me is that this is going to be shoehorning a particular position of Rabbi Meir into a lot of cases where it doesn't fit so easily. That's my gut, but I don't know. I haven't done the survey, but every time you see it come up, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, here we go again. We know Rabbi Meir Shita. That's all. It's one case. That's what I said. It's or case is the Katan and Katan of Yibum, but I'm not sure, you know, how compelling it will be. I'm going to put it that way, and every time this is going to come up in Shas. But the Gemara itself will periodically invoke it. It's Rabbi Meir who's Choshesh L'miuta. If you look in the...
Every time somebody's looking for a PhD topic, that's...
So if you look even in the Mesoros HaShas, and I don't know if it's I don't know how it's printed in the newer Gemaras, but you can look on the side, and the reference is Rabbi Meir Chayesh Lemiuta. I count something like 11 places where it's just elsewhere in Shas. Now there may be some overlap and duplicates of cases, but that the concept is invoked fairly frequently. Okay. So anyway, so with that background of Rabbi Meir Shita, so the Gemara says as follows: Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, mimnei ma asu gavinas unyaki. Why did they prohibit, according to Rabbi Meir, why did they prohibit this cheese? The answer is mimnei sherov agolim shel osair nishchatim laavodas kochavim. A majority of the calves. Now the assumption is that when they would make the cheese, one of the things that they would do is they would take the stomach lining of animals that they had slaughtered, and they would dip that into the milk, and that would cause the cheese to curdle. So you have the actual stomach, which is basar from the animal. Leave aside the question of basar b'challah for the moment. That's a separate discussion. We'll eventually get to that. But for them, they would take this meat from the animal that they shechted. And they would, because there's rennet in the stomach lining, they would dip it into the milk, and magic, you would get the process of curdling would begin. So apparently, Rove of the Agalim were slaughtered l'shem avodazara. And once the Agalim are slaughtered l'shem avodazara, so every part of the animal is aser b'hana. That's the assumption. And therefore, if you make the cheese with this particular stomach, so the cheese takes on the status of the davar hamamid, of the rennet, or whatever chemical or substance you used to cause the milk to become cheese. So the Gemara will comment about that at the end, because you can't taste the stomach, but the Gemara comments that since it's mamid, it's like the iser is still there. We've addressed this a little bit already. So since there's a rove, so therefore it's aser b'hana. So now the Gemara says, one second, my ear Yerov, Agalim. Why do you have to tell me that a majority of Agalim in that city was slaughtered for Avodah Zarah, afilu miut nami, even if a minority were, the Harabi Meir Chayesh Lemiuta? Because Rabbi Meir is Choshesh Lemiuta. Now, there's another question the Gemara could have asked. I don't know if Tosas might ask doesn't ask the question this way, but the question could be asked according to, if it's Rov Agalim, or Nishchatim Lavodah Zarah, why did the Chachamim permit the cheese, Bahana? After all, if Rova the rennet, or the curdling, you know, catalyst happens to be Asar Bana, so why would the Chachamim argue, Rabbi Meir? So the Gemara says, so one answer will answer both questions. And the Gemara says, no, Iamis Rov, Ika Miut. If you say that there's a rove of Agolim that are slaughtered Lavodazara, then we can talk about there being a Miut overall of all the rent being used of being prohibited by na. Ela I amris miut. If you say it's only a minority of calves that are used, kevan the ika rova golem the enish chatem lavodas kochavim. Since a majority of calves are not slaughtered for avodah zarah, the ika nami shar behemos the enan the shchatem lavodas kochavim. And then they might have used again. I guess they more commonly use the stomach of a calf, but they might have used a different animal's stomach. So now it's a double rove. Number one, it's almost it's more not like a, so much two roves. It's like a sveik sveika. Number one, maybe they use the calf, the stomach of a regular animal, and even which they don't shech lavo dezara. And even if they use the stomach of a calf, well, maybe. Most calves are not shech to lavo dezara. So if that were the case, the Gemara says havale miuta de miuta. Rabbi Meir. Even Rabbi Meir is not choshesh for a mir of a mir. Now, of course, the question is, what does that mean, a mir of a mir? In other words, if it's still a possibility, you know, half of something is still something. Right? Half of a kol shehu, as we would say, is a kol shehu. So what difference does it make whether it's a sin miyut or miyuta de miyuta? So this is what I was suggesting before, that it seems to be almost kind of what called discrete possibilities, or it's a decision-making tree. And if you have only one decision to make, and there are only two possibilities, even though one is by far a statistical majority, Rabbi Meir says, we are concerned about which path you go down. Now that's my hole-in-one on my first shot in golf. But once you already have the tree forks twice, it's almost like it's what you might call a sveik sveika. Number one, maybe it's the it was done by a regular behemoth, and nobody shechs regular behemoths for avodah zarah, and in that city at least. And even if it was a calf, well, maybe it was a calf that wasn't a slaughtered avodah zarah. So, if Rabbi Meir would say the following, if the decision making, if the branch of the tree that has calves, most of the calves are shecht lavo dezara, then basically that we sort of define that as simply one path. And the rove says that nishchat lavo dezara, and therefore we're back to having sort of one fork in the tree. But once you already say that you have a rove in that branch, that a rove are not nishchat lavo dezara, that's called the mi'uta de mi'uta. That possibility is too remote, that discrete possibility is too remote, and therefore Rabbi Meir says, even Rabbi Meir is not choshesh l'mi'uta.
I mean, that reflects a pretty insophisticated understanding of probability theory, because obviously if you had two 49% forks, you'd have a radically higher chance than a 0.04% sris. And so the question is, I'm curious whether there is an alternative sort of halachic avenue where people say, you know, no, miuta dimiuta is not the only paradigm you could use to decide what level of uncertainty or risk we're willing to
take. So I don't think that, I think Chazal were quite well aware of probability. They understood that quite well. The sugya of ruba, called the parish me ruba parish, but called kavua kamechza mechza, I mean, that I described before with the 10 butcher shops, they understood quite well the difference between the two. Right, they understood that. I think, I don't fully understand why, and as I think we live in a world that tends to be more dominated by statistics, although psychologically speaking, not always the case. Sometimes we do think sometimes in discrete possibilities, and we are marbid the miut and mamayit the riboy. So I don't know why, it's, you know, Chazal do not provide us, as best as I can tell, with a philosophy, you know, of this particular halachic view, but it's one that may show itself in more than in multiple places. I don't know the lumdus so well, but there are different approaches to understanding why a sveik sveika is permitted. And some understand, the obvious one is that when we say that a sveik sveika might be osur, sveik menator, sveika deraisa lechumra, but sveik sveika might be lakula, some say because it's a probability question. But others say that no, it's not strictly based upon probability, it's based upon possibilities, if you want to call it that. And I suspect that some of that may have to do, it's sort of easier to swallow that, in a situation when we're talking about things that are not necessarily a reflection of the physical world. In other words, if you take the Rush's idea that I can take all three pieces of meat, you know, they have it, and you put them in a sandwich, you know, in the physical world, I'm consuming the tray of meat. But the halachic system says it doesn't matter. Sometimes it's not my relationship, to the cheftza that actually matters, but somehow we evaluate, you know, what you know, more of the action rather than the result, if you want to call it that. And so if we were talking about something like sakana, something that was dangerous, and we know that chamira sakanta meisura, that by sakana you can't rely upon a miut. So there, I think it's clear, nobody would say, oh, but it's a sveik sveika by a sakana, so it's mutter. I think there it's clear, when its relationship is to the physical world, we would say that anything that's above X percentage, above this threshold of danger, you're not allowed to do. Below that, you're allowed to do. But I think in the realm of things that are not necessarily mapped purely to the physical world, so there it may be that, I don't know why, again, Chazal don't articulate this, but it may be that they're more interested in other kinds of ways of looking and thinking. Okay, now, again, not everybody agrees. Look, the bottom line is, we don't hold like Rabbi Meir. I'm not sure what our story is by Sveik Sveika, whether we would allow a Sveik Sveika when it's killed less than a row. But nonetheless, certainly you can envision the Kavua case is the one that should sort of tip you off. That they know what probability is, and sometimes they think that discrete possibilities are more relevant than probabilities. Okay. So that's what the Gemara says. So, and the Chachamim, now once we explain that Rov HaGolim are Nishchatim L'Avodah Zarah and Rabbi Meir's Choshesh L'Miyuta, you understand why the Chachamim aren't concerned, because even though a majority of calves are slaughtered for Avodah Zarah purposes, but the majority of calves are not a majority of animals. The majority of animals are not slaughtered L'Avodah Zarah because you have Shair Behemos, then you have a small number of the calves that aren't as well, and therefore the Chachamim say, it's Aser B'Achila, we don't know why yet, you can't eat the cheese, but it's not Aser Bahana. Okay, so now the Gemara tells the following. So Reish Lakish was the one who had explained why Rabbi Meir prohibits Bahana. So now the Gemara gets into an interesting kind of detail. So here again, a little bit of background as well. When you bring a karban in the Beis HaMikdash, there are four major avodos, which are necessary for the karban to be good, and those are essentially the only four actions of the karban that if you mess things up, you can really invalidate the karban. They are, number one, shechita, which may be done by any Jew, kohen, non-kohen, man, woman, probably child too, I don't know if child, but certainly man and woman. Kabbalas Hadam, this has to be already starts with a Kohen. He has to receive the blood directly from the animal in some type of a vessel. Holacha, walking into the Mizbeach, and then Zrikas Hadam, throwing the dam however it gets thrown on the Mizbeach. Whatever, each carbon sort of has its own different thing. If you say Ezehu Makoman in the morning as part of Kabbalah, so you get all the basic details. Now, if you get those four avodos right, you're in generally pretty good shape. There are other things that you're supposed to do, but most of them will not prevent the karban from having satisfied the requirement that it was brought for. Now, one of the requirements when you do the four avodos, other than doing them properly in a physical fashion, is you have to have the proper intent. Or a better way of putting it is you may not have improper intent. So, for example, you may not think when you are doing one of those four avodos that you intend to eat from that karban at a time you're not allowed to eat from it, meaning past its time, or in a place that you're not allowed to eat it, either outside of Yerushalayim, outside of the Mikdash, but again, depends upon the karban. That type of machshava is known as pigel, or you're not allowed to think when you're bringing a karban olah that this should be l'shem chatas, or l'shem pesach, or l'shem some other karban. There are a number of machshavos that you're not supposed to have when you're bringing a karban. So now, I know this seems very, very removed from our station where we in life, given that we don't have animal sacrifice to start with. Supposing the following. Supposing a Kohen, anybody, doesn't have the Kohen. Let's say a Kohen shechs the animal, he does the shechita, and while he's doing the shechita, his intent is to throw the blood with the intent of doing it eating chutzlim koma or chutzlis manu, eating the koma chutzlis manu. The question is, can you have a machshava in one avoda to do another avoda improperly? That's the question. I know, it seems, since animal sacrifice is very removed from our world, this seems to even be more steps removed. But that's the question. Av mechashvin me avoda le avoda. Now, why does this matter? Because it matters in terms of sacrificing, bringing the animal for avodah zarah. The Gemara works with an assumption that the purpose that a guy is not interested in doing normally shechita for Avodah Zarah. What he's really interested in doing is burning. Listen, if you shech the animal, it's very nice, but your God doesn't get any benefit from it. But if you burn the fat on his altar, so then he gets to eat. So the assumption is that when someone shechs the animal, the shechita, for Avodah Zarah, his real intent, he's not doing the shechita l'shem Avodah Zarah. What he's doing is the haktara l'shem Avodah Zarah. When he burns the parts of the animal that he burns, that's what's being done for his God. So that's an example then. And if his intent is not to do shechita for the Avodah Zarah, but to do ultimately the haktara, and the shechita is just a means to getting there, so that would be the analog of machashme avodah l'avodah. And then the question is there such a principle by Avodah Zarah? It happens to be, it happens from a halachic vantage point. I don't know how the idolatrous priests paskin, but there are, by the way, a lot of connections when we talk about between, it's obvious, between temple ritual and Avodah Zarah. For example, one of the definitions of Avodah Zarah, we've encountered this before, a while back. When you do Avodah Zarah, in order to be liable for capital punishment, you have to do one of two things. You either have to worship the Avodah Zarah in the way that Avodah Zarah is normally worshipped. So if it's mercury, the way the Gemara describes, you have to throw a stone to it, or if you do any one of the four avodos pnim, the four avodos that were sort of central inside the mikdash, not the four I just listed, but burning something, libating something, slaughtering, and bowing down, which you would worship in the mikdash that way as well.
Intention doesn't play any role.
What's that?
An intention doesn't play any role.
Well, no, you. I mean, yes, it does. You have to be intending to worship. If you bend down to pick up your wallet that's in front of Avodah Zarah, that's not called Ishtachava. But the point is that if I took a stone and I threw it at Baal Peor, I'm not Chayim Misa for that, because nobody worships Baal Peor that way, and stone throwing, ordinarily, was not one of the forms of Avodah inside the temple. Now, if the temple were built today, I'm not sure. But once upon a time, stone throwing was just not one of the Avodos. They did throw a Srogan, but that wasn't part of the Avodah. So the point is, in order to be Chayim Misa for worshipping Avodah Zarah, it has to be, unless it's the way you normally worship Avodah Zarah, it's modeled upon Avodos Pinim. It has to be one of those four Avodos. Any other Avodah, you get Malchus, probably you don't get Misa. So it's not great. In other words, this is an issue, you know, Pesach's coming up. I don't know if I'm exactly what I'm talking about the Shabbos, but Yayin Mavushal, right? Yayin Mavushal, why is there no Gzeir on Yayin Nesach? Because you can't use, they didn't libate Yayin Mavushal to the Avodah Zarah. Now, Yayin Mavushal is also Pasol Agabe HaMizbeach. So there is very often connections that are drawn between monotheistic sacrificial worship, mm-hmm, and polytheistic sacrificial worship. So the same issue is a machlokas Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan here. Now, why is this relevant here? Because what did Reish Lakish say? Reish Lakish wanted to explain for Rabbi Meir, why is it that the Gvina space Unyaki is prohibited Behana? And the answer was, because most of those calves are slaughtered to bring them to the Avodah Zarah. So you see that they did Shechita, and the Shechita makes it Asar Behana. Here's the problem. Amar le Reb Shimon ben Eliyakim le Reb Shimon ben Lakish. He asks Reish Lakish, Ki nishchatin lavodos kochav v'mayave. What's the big deal? V'ha atu d'shari. You should permit it. De itmar. Hashochet es abehema lizrog dama lavodos kochavim. Or lahaktir chelba lavodos kochavim. If a, presumably non-Jew, but could be a Jew too, slaughters an animal, not l'shem Avodah Zarah, but with the intent of later throwing the blood or burning the fats, l'shem Avodah Zarah, Rabbi Yochanan Amar Asura, Kosabar Mechashrin Me'avodah L'Avodah. Rabbi Yochanan says the entire animal is prohibited by Noah because you can have Machshava in one Avodah to do another Avodah improperly, and that already counts. You don't have to do the second Avodah, it's gone. In general, when you do a Machshava, if you have a Machshava when you shecht an animal, a carbon, in the Mikdash, you have a Machshava to eat from the animal beyond its appointed time, chutz l'zmano, at that point the animal is pigle. It doesn't matter whether you eat it in its time or after its time, you still violate the prohibition of eating pigle. So the same day here, it doesn't matter what you do later, if you shechted it with the intent of burning the fats, l'avodah zarah, Rabbi Yochanan says, mechashra me'avodah l'avodah, you're not allowed to get benefit from this animal. But Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, amar muteres. So Rabbi Shimon Lakish says, no. He says it's mutter because ein mechashron lavoda leavoda. Why? I'm sorry. Skip. Rabbi Yochanan says v'yalfinan chutz mipnim. Rabbi Yochanan says you learn avoda which is done outside the temple from the avoda that's done inside the temple. And if inside the temple, mechashrim avoda l'avoda, so therefore outside the temple, in a monotheistic or a polytheistic context, mechashrim avoda l'avoda, and therefore the entire animal is asar bana, even though you did the shechita just so that you could burn the animal avoda zara, but you didn't do the shechita itself l'shem avoda zara. So Amar Lei, Reish Lakish says to Reb Shimon ben Eliakim, Tirminoch mazla shaitach. Not clear, it's a very unusual phrase. In my Misorah Shas doesn't even have this expression anywhere else in Shas. Rashi says, Yomer mazlach. It sounds to me like Yashikoach. Good question. Okay, your mazel should be elevated or something. I don't know. The Reish Lakish answer is Be'omer Be'gvar Zvicha Hu Ovda. Now this is a very funny answer. What Reish Lakish really is saying is that this is a case in that place in Beis Onyaki, they used to worship. They used to shecht agolim l'shem avodah zarah, not shecht agolim to burn l'shem avodah. Maybe they did that too, but they did the shechita. Should be the avodah itself. They're killing the animal, they're slaughtering the animal for the avodah zarah. The odd thing here is that, and the Rishonim are bothered by this, but I don't really want to dwell upon this. Why does he say bigmar zvicha to hey ovda? Say that zvicha will be its avoda. What does he mean when the shechita is over? I want that to be the avoda. It has to do with a different sugya in Baba Kama, where the Gemara is preoccupied dealing with some other technical issue unrelated to us, where the question that's discussed is, how is the process of shechita viewed? Is it viewed as one long continuous process? Yeshna l'shechita amitchila v'yatzof? Or do you say that shechita really is looked at a point, that when you cross the threshold, the 50%, that the concluding part of shechita, eina l'shechita ela b'sof? I don't want to talk about why that issue matters. It matters the machlokas, I think, Reish Lakish or Yochanan Baba Kama. Reish Lakish, as Rashi points out, happens to hold eina l'shechita ela l'b'sof. And that's why the Gemara here says it really isn't necessary here. But that's why the Gemara here, it quotes Reish Lakish is really saying that in this case the guy was slaughtering as a form of sacrificial worship. It wasn't just to prepare the animal to be burned, you know, its fats to be burned on the idolatrous altar. But rather, he wanted the shechita also to be l'shem avodah zarah. Therefore, it's not a question of mechashrim avodah l'avodah. This avodah itself is l'shem avodah zarah, and therefore, all of these calves are asur b'hana, and since they constitute a minority of the stomachs that are used to make cheese, Rabbi Meir is choshesh l'mi'uta, and that's why he says that gevinas beis unyaki is prohibited b'hana. Okay, fine. The end of that. Now, we have to get to cheese itself. We're not going to get there today, but we're going to get there, Mirtz Hashem, next week. But in the meantime, we have to go back to the Mishnah and review, because to understand the next part of the dialogue. And this is very appropriate this time of year, because we will be reading, God willing, Shir HaShirim in 3 weeks from yesterday. Yes. 3 weeks from yesterday, last day of Pesach, I think, is when we're going to read Shir HaShirim, right? I think it's the eighth day?
Friday.
Not the first day, right? What's that? On Israel, they have to read the first Shabbos, right? But we'll read it on the second Shabbos, I think. So, in the Mishnah, we have the following. Amar Rabbi Yehuda.
What's that?
On Daf of Tesamid Beis. In the Mishnah itself, where you have, it's about halfway through the Mishnah, where you have the Hagos Habach, the letter Aleph, two lines above that. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Shaul Rabbi Yishmael as Rabbi Yoshua kishahayu mechalchem bederach. Rabbi Yishmael, who was a Talmud of Rabbi Yoshua, he and Rabbi Akiva were Talmidim, he asked Rabbi Yoshua the following question. Mipnei ma osru gevinos ovdei kochavim. Why did they prohibit non-Jews cheese? Amar lo, so we may discuss this a little more. We discussed it once, but briefly to recapitulate. Rabbi Yeshua said that they take a nevela, you have an animal that was not slaughtered properly, and they take the stomach contents, probably it was a calf that had nursed, and they take the milk out of that stomach, a little bit of that milk, and they put it a little bit in the cheese, and that causes causes the milk to curdle. So the assumption in the first answer is that the keva itself is usur to eat. And of course, that's problematic, because if the calf nursed, the milk contents are not part, if, even if the calf is not slaughtered properly, it means you can't eat the meat of the calf. You can't eat the stomach of the calf, but the stomach contents are something external. If anything, the way we paskin, what matters more is what the status of the animal that the calf nursed from. If it nursed from a non-kosher animal or a cow, which was a trefa, and you can't consume the milk, then you shouldn't be able to consume the stomach contents. But if it nursed from a kosher cow, then who cares what the status of the calf is? It should be permissible to consume the keva. And that's what Rabbi Yishmael responds to him. So he says to him, "Valo keva amar lo, valo kevas ola chamura mi kevas nevela." The carbon ola, you're not allowed to get any hanah from. It's all burned on the mizbeach. Yet the Gemara says the din is amru kohen shadata yafar sarfachaya. If a kohen wants to swallow it whole, he's allowed to do so. Now, you can't eat any other part of the ola. It's aser bana. It's kachay kadashim. It has to be burned on the mizbeach. But nonetheless, if a kohen wants to eat the keva that's found inside, let's say you slaughtered a young calf as a carbon ola, it has to be male for an ola, and you slaughter it, and you find the milk contents, the kohen wants to, I mean, again, dato yafa is a euphemism. It doesn't, dato yafa usually means someone sensitive and a little mifunak. Dato yafa here means a little bit crude. So a kohen who wants to do that can swallow it whole. So how can you tell me that kevas nevela is more problematic than kevas ola? And again, I should emphasize here to the terminology. Or hakeva is the stomach lining. It means it's the stomach itself. Keva means the stomach contents. So amar lo mimnei shemamid denoso bekevas egle avodas kochavim. So he says, no, you know why? Because they are mamid it with the stomach context of a calf that was slaughtered lavo dezar. Now the Mishnah is making it, Rabbi Yeshua is making an assumption here that the Gemara is going to point out in a second, that the stomach contents of a calf that is slaughtered lavo dezar, the stomach contents also become usher. Now it's not crazy. Why is it not crazy? Because the issue of the stomach, the issue is that when I take the knife and I slaughter the calf lavo dezara, I am slaughtering the entire calf. Presumably from head to toe is part of my sacrifice. So I could understand why, even though the stomach contents come from an external source, it all might be prohibited bahana as I slaughter the calf. But if that's the case, amar lo, imkein lama lo asura bahana? Why? If the issue is the calf with its stomach contents was slaughtered for avodah zarah, it shouldn't be mutar b'achila, it should be asur b'hana, like Rabbi Meir. So either he shio or he seal the davar acher. Tosus on Aradaf, it's in the wrong place. On Lambad Lambdan days, belongs on the Mishnah. Either he seduced him to another topic or he sort of changed the topic. He carried him to another topic. And amar lo, Yishmael achi, heich ata kore, ki tovim dodecha miyayin o ki tovim dodayich. So here you have to know the psukim. And it starts, Yishakeni minishikos pihu, ki tovim, we have dodecha miyayin. And so he asked them, is it dodecha o dodayich? Now the difference is, who's talking to whom? Is it God talking to Knesset Yisrael? Or is it the dod talking to his raya? Or is it the raya talking to the dod? So it all depends whether it's dodecha, is the woman talking to the man, and dodayich is the man talking to the woman. So which is it? So he says to him, amar lo, ki tovim dodayich. He got it wrong. He failed his Tanakh Bechina. So Amar Lo, although the truth is not a surprise, I discovered something shocking today. Again, I'm not sure which daf it is. It's yesterday's, today's, or tomorrow's. They talk about what is a parent obligate, or father technically, obligated to teach his son in terms of Torah. So the Gemara claims he's only mechuyev to teach him, not mechuyev to teach him Mishnah. Only mechuyev to teach him Mikra, and the way Rashi reads the Gemara, only Chumash, not even Nevi'im and Ksuvim. So a father's responsibility to teach his son only applies to Chumash. After that, Mishnah, so Jeremy, you're on your own. You got to go get your own education. Which is interesting. So that's why maybe Rabbi Yishmael's father only taught him Chumash, but he didn't teach him Nevi'im and Ksuvim. So he got it wrong. He said, Ki tovim do dayich miayim. So he said, no, Amar lo ena davar kein, wrong. It can't be. You know why? Shechare chamei ramalam ena lav. Because the next pasuk says, l'reach shimonecha tovim. Now, you might say, of course, well, maybe that should be l'reach shimonayach tovim. So, either Rashi or Tosus point out, the proof might be from the end of the pasuk, which is, al kein alamos ahivucha. And at that point, you're saying the young maidens love you. It can't be ahivuch. It's not that kind of love, not in that world, certainly. And so the point is that obviously it's the raya talking to the dod, so it has to be the raya shmanecha, and it has to be kitovim dodecha. So basically, he changed the topic. And that was the end of the story. And the Mishnah doesn't tell us. Rabbi Yeshua did not answer Rabbi Yishmael. So, now, let's come to our Gemara first. Quickly, one issue that we have to deal with is a very interesting question. The women might take exception to this, not the women in the room, but I suspect that the person who gets married under the following circumstances will be divorced very quickly. Amar Rav Achadvai, Amar Rav, Hamakadesh Beperesh Shor HaNiskol, Mekudeshes. Okay? This has not ever happened. Isaac, this is a truly theoretical case. Okay, a man comes under the chuppah, and he goes to, and instead of giving a ring, he takes a jar of excrement from a cow, okay, which has value. It could be used as fuel or fertilizer, whatever else. But what's the problem? What did this chacham do? It was from a shor haniskal. Now, what's a shor haniskal? A shor haniskal is a shor that was sentenced to death. Let's keep it simple here, because it gored a person to death. So the Beis Din sentences, judges the shor with 23 judges, sentences it to death. As soon as it's sentenced to death, it's aser bana. But let's say they stone it, doesn't matter if you slaughter it, it's still aser bana. And now this person extracts the contents of the intestines, saves it, and now wants to be mekadesh with it. So the question is it the real question, this is, I don't know if this is rabbinic sense of humor, it's just their way of expressing it, is it mutter bahana or aser bahana? Okay? Are you allowed to get benefit from peresh or shor haniskal or not? So Rav Chadvai said, if you mekadesh a woman with it, she's mekudeshes. Why? Obviously it's mutter bahana. However, Beferesh egle avodas kochavim ain't a mekudeshes. If you took an egel that was slaughtered for avodah zarah and you took its stomach contents and you mekadesh a woman, she's not mekudeshes. Why? Because that's aser bana. Now you understand why the Gemara is saying this here. What's this doing here? So the Gemara now says, firstly it explains, ibay seima svara, ibay seima kra. You could either say it's based upon a pasuk or based upon a logic. So ibay seima svara. By an egel that for avodah zarah, the greater, the fatter the egel looks, the more a desirable sacrifice. That's what people used to do. That the pasuk in Shoftim, when it talks about Gideon, when he slaughtered one of the animals, it said par hasheni sheva shanim. So they explained they had been fattening that cow to slaughter for 7 years. So he took that instead of letting it be used for Baal, he slaughtered it to God. So the fatter the animal is, and if after the animal is eaten, it is a little bit expanded, so it's more valuable for the Zara. Therefore, he's happy that the perish is part of the animal. Therefore, when he slaughters the animal, that's part of his machshava, part of his thought process, that's the shame of the Zara. However, by a shor haniskal, who cares whether or not the cow looks fat or not? The bottom line is, you're losing the cow, the ox, you have to slaughter it. It makes no difference to you. Therefore, there's no reason that the perish should become aser bana. But what makes the perish the egel of avodah zarah aser bana is your intent. And you benefit. It's nicer to bring that to your avodah zarah. Therefore, it's aser bana. Now, it could be based upon psukim. You're not allowed to get even a ma'uma benefit from avodah zarah, and ma'uma could even be the parish. However, the basar, the meat, is prohibited, but the stomach contents are not prohibited. Okay. And then Amar Rava, and why is this here? Because Rava points out that it's implied in the Mishnah. Amar Rava Tarvayu Tanani. Both of them are implied in our Mishnah. Midka Amar Le Mitneisha Mamidem Mekevas Navela Mekama Hader Le. Now, so that Rabbi Yeshua said the reason the cheese is aser is because they use Kevas Navela. Vekama Hader Le Rabbi Yishmael responded Velo Kevas Ola Chamurami Kevas Navela. So he said that a Kevas Ola is more stringent, and yet the Kohen's allowed to eat it. Michlal the Isurehena Asher Repushayu by default. An Ola is prohibited by Hana. Nonetheless, Rabbi Yishmael says, and Rabbi Yeshua doesn't challenge us, that a Kohen is allowed to eat it. Meaning, the perish of an Ola is Mutar Bahana. Therefore, the perish of other Isuri Hana, generally speaking, is also Mutar Bahana. Umi the Amar Lei, but when Rabbi Yeshua responds, it says, Memeshim Amidro So Bekevas Egleo Dos Kochavim. Rabbi Yeshua gives his last substantive response and says that no, the reason why it's Aser is because they use the stomachs of calves that were slaughtered for Avodah Zarah to be Mamed the cheese. They use the perish there. And Rabbi Yishmael responded by saying, "Im came lama lo asura bahana." He said, "Then the cheese should be asar bahana." Michlal davodas kochavim asar pirshayu. So then you see, that in fact, The perish of an egel of Otzkochavim is Aser Bahana. So both dinim are implied in the Mishnah. The fact that you can benefit from the stomach context of an Ola, but you cannot get benefit from the stomach context of the Zara shows you that not all Yisuri Hana were created equal. And that the default option of Yisuri Hana is the perish is really mutter, it's really permitted, but Abu Dazar is the exception because it's the logic the Gemara gives is either Nihale ben Afche, he wants the shore to look, the eagle to look big, to look fat, because that's a nicer thing to bring to your God, or because the Torah says, V'lo yidbach biyadacha me'uma menachem, even the smallest amen. Okay. So then, the Gemara asks a question. V'lihader lei, why didn't Rabbi Yeshua couldn't respond to the last question, and he didn't want to give the real answer. He couldn't sort of push Rabbi Yishmael off, there was a good answer. V'lihader lei, why didn't Rabbi Yishmael be machzir? Why didn't he respond to Rabbi Yishmael by saying, Mishum delesa li'isur ba'ene? You know why you're allowed to get hana from this cheese? Because the isur doesn't exist anymore. Why? Because it's just the rennet made the milk change. But you don't really have the rennet there. Now, why does that change things? So he says, the Hamurias l'Rabbanan, the Lo Asura B'Hana. The Rabbanan, why did the Rabbanan not make Murias Asur B'Hana? Rabbi Meir, Rabbi, and the Chachamim don't argue about what Murias is. They agree that sometimes the non-Jew mixes a little bit of wine in. So why don't the Chachamim prohibit that wine? The answer is, my time, Alav Mishum, the Leisali Sura Be'ene. Must be because the wine is totally indiscernible, so they don't allow you to get hana. They don't allow you to eat the fish oil which had wine mixed in, but they're not going to prohibit it by hana because it's not be'en anymore. That's not really extant. It's not like yayin esach mixed into yayin esach. So the Gemara says, no. Amre, you say, hacha, kevan de ukme kamukim, chashev le kaman de isa lesur b'nei. When you have a davar hamaimid, it's not batel, it's there. In other words, it's true, the rennet, the chemical rennet, you can't see and you can't taste. But if you want to know, was there rennet here? The answer is, of course it is, because you're not looking at a cup of milk anymore, you're looking at a block of cheese. So what the Gemara is saying here is that whenever you have a davar hama'amid, it's like the isser is actually be'en. It's not just that you can taste it in some way, it's actually as if it is still here. That's why a davar hama'amid is never batel. And that's why in this case, if the davar hama'amid had been the peresh from an egel that was slaughtered for Avodah Zarah, the stomach contents, it would be as if the stomach contents, which are Aser B'Hana, are still here right in front of you when you see the cheese, and that's why Rabbi Yoshua conceded to Rabbi Yishmael, without saying anything, that you're right. That if the reason why they made a gzeira against the cheese of Gvinas Beis Unyaki was because they're mamming it with the keva of an egel that was slaughtered for Avodah Zarah, then it would be Aser B'Hana, and I'm not telling you the reason, so let's talk about something else. That's how the Gemara leaves it. And so next time, we will, God willing, begin to talk about actually why Rabbi Yishmael quoted that pasuk, and then what is the reason for Gevinas Akum, and what are the implications for us.